Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Jim and Austin, welcome. Austin, you just wrote an on-point column this week on basically it was about the winding down of Iraq and what's going to actually happen at the end of 2011. Maybe you could just briefly give us a synopsis of that.
Well, in my view, the discussion of that American combat troops are going to be all pulled out of Iraq is misleading. It's misleading from a lot of angles, in part because we have promised to keep a training and logistical support mission there, and that requires security. Whether we go around talking about, and I didn't address this in the column, but this is something that I know Jim spent a good deal of time with, talking about private security agencies, many of them going to be hired, at least under State Department auspices, to provide security for some ongoing U.S. Diplomatic and support operations. I don't think that's very realistic. But you do have the Status of Forces Agreement that was reached right at the end of the Bush administration that it leaves the door open for the United States to be invited by the Iraqi government to retain a certain number of troops in Iraq. Now, I'm going to leap to the bottom of my column. I started talking about Iraqi airspace security issues, which is a fancy way of talking about Air Force and air defense. And I point out that the Iraqis are now back to talking about, very seriously, about buying F-16s, even though I note that here it is on July 14th, a Thursday, and I wrote that column on July the 2nd, a Tuesday, but there was a wire service report yesterday afternoon from the Iraqi Defense Ministry that said, oh, no, we're not going to conclude that F-16 deal. Well, they've been sending messages, yes, we are, no, we're not, maybe we will for at least 2.5 years. And as a quick sidelight on that, Omar al-Nadawi, the Iraq the Model blogger, and I wrote a piece that ran in the Wall Street Journal on September 11th, 2009. That's a heck of a date, September 11th, where we talked about Iraqi airspace security and why we thought the Iraqis needed Western jets, and we said F-16s, just because of the serviceability of F-16s and the fact that there are other allied air forces. The U.S. has a good support package for it that they supply F-16s as well. And they needed an integrated air defense capability, new surface air missiles and the like, just to provide airspace protection for their own country. And it was going to take to be an investment. It's going to take some investment to buy the aircraft, procure some of the modern Western systems. And yes, Iran we saw as the potential threat, but they needed to realize that they had a 5 to 7 year training and acquisition program if they were going to really seriously build a small but efficient air force that could adequately defend their airspace. That was 2 years ago, Dan. So I mention that because this is an issue I've been following for quite some time, and here it is, 2011. If it takes a minimum of 5 years, and I'm not the only person that's talked about 2016, you can find material on the internet coming from Iraqi Ministry of Defense officials saying, we realize that it's going to be 2016 at the earliest. In fact, there was one I read several months ago where one of the officials was saying, hey, it might be 2018 before we are capable of defending our airspace on our own. Now, I don't know how the politicians, well, I do know how the games the politicians have played. Troops, they're meaning ground troops, combat troops. Well, I'll tell you, U.S. Air Force F-15C pilots, that's the air defense version, F-16 pilots, and the like, they're they're combat forces. Iraq needs an air defense capability. Is the air defense issue going to go away December 31st, 2011, if supposedly all of the U.S. Forces are withdrawn? No, it's not. And you've got that five to seven year gap staring you, staring Iraq in the face. I did touch on in the column right at the last, and there is some diplomatic talk about, well, maybe we could work out some sort of alliance type agreement. And I mentioned Turkey, Jordan, and Kuwait. And there's some talk of, well, maybe we base the U.S. Air Forces in southeastern Turkey, which using a huge NATO base in Incirlik or in Kuwait. But you're still using relying in some degree on U.S. forces, and you're not providing the kind of on-call air defense capability that Iraq needs around Baghdad, and especially to guard that Baghdad-Basra corridor. Now, I've been talking from the military side of the issue. It is a complex diplomatic and political thicket that both Baghdad and Washington, for a variety of reasons, domestic political reasons at play in both the United States and Iraq, that Baghdad and Washington got themselves in a terrible political tangle. Part of the Iraqi government is very aware of the utility of maintaining some U.S. forces, which is why they use the term night light in the column. Now, there was always, even after 1989, was talk of, should we keep a U.S. night light in Germany? And it wasn't just the United States saying that. It was Germans saying that as well, and the French and British, because of the keeping a U.S. super armored division or something based in Germany, still sent a message ultimately to Moscow about U.S. commitment to the defense of Western Europe, even though the Western European border had now moved to the Polish border, the eastern Poland's eastern border. So there was a political component in that that was referred to as the American nightlight. There are Iraqis that realize the utility of that. I mentioned in the column the Iraqi Quick Reaction Corps, which is regarded as the crack forces within the Iraqi army. But then even those units are, they're uneven. Some of them have not fielded their full, they don't have all the battalions, they don't have all the artillery support battalions in the Quick Reaction Corps. And if you look at it again from the military angle, retaining even just a couple of U.S. heavy brigades, mech infantry and tanks, provides a useful training base, but also a backup, not so much for the internal security mission, but definitely the border security mission, and you're looking at Iran as the problem. Another part that plays into Iraqi interests, even though I didn't address it per se in the column. There is some unease in Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's government with the army. Army improving, growing power, because you think, okay, we're an emerging democracy, but the military coup is a possibility. Maintaining the U.S. force there as an example of the way soldiers serving a democracy, professional soldiers serving a democracy work. That, you've got that as the example on the ground and in close contact. Working against it from the Iraqi political perspective are guys like Muqtada al-Sadr and his Mookie Army, as we used to call it. Extremist Shia militia. Now, in my view, Sadr is nothing more than a mouthpiece for Iran. But what what he says is that he's, even though he backtracked on this after he said it, a couple of weeks ago he said, if the United States doesn't pull out, I'm going to have my militia attack the remaining U.S. forces. And then he said, no, I'm not going to do that. But he did issue this. He says, all Iraqis that cooperated with U.S. and coalition forces, we will, and he didn't use the term revenge, but that's what he meant. He says, you know, there's going to be payback. But he was talking about we're going to take revenge on these people because they're traitors. Well, they're not. The two leading people who have committed themselves to this democratic process, you potentially lead them over to depredations by a thug like Sadr. Now, I've kind of gone through the Iraqi situation, U.S. situation. Candidate Barack Obama, you know, the good war was Afghanistan and Iraq was a mess. Now, President Barack Obama's view is a little bit different. Recall last year, even Vice President Biden was talking about Iraq as an emerging success for the Obama administration foreign policy. He got laughed at. He said that on Larry King Live in the spring of 2010. He was just taken to the cleaners, excoriated for it, but the Obama administration did recognize that Iraq is an emerging success. It's one that still needs nurturing. But Obama had promised that all combat troops would be out in August of 2010, and then everybody would be gone by December of 2011. And that's what he said. Now he's got to backtrack on it. As I pointed out in the column, the new Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, is publicly, without talking about backtracking, he's publicly appealing to the Iraqi government to say, make a decision. Do you want us to stay? Invite us. Now, that's going on in diplomatic channels that are not public. The diplomats do understand the tangles that I've just described, and both from Washington and Baghdad perspective. I believe that the Iraqi government needs to make that invitation, and couch it in whatever opaque language it needs to for its own political purposes. But it's to go. Do I think Iraq fails if it doesn't do it? No. There's actually some structural strength in Iraq now. You are going to have U.S. special forces. You will have all those support components. But I think ultimately it's in Iraq's interest as well as the U.S. interest to maintain troops there. Now, this isn't exactly answering your question about the drawdown. I'm actually looking at drawdown slight increase, but looking at how the Iraq and U.S. bilateral defense arrangements would continue over at least the next 5 to 7 years. So that's the background of that column that's up at the strategy page.
Jim, your thoughts?
Well, the Iraqi army has been trying to get up to speed, I guess for at least 5 years now. The big problem has always been the more pressing need for, counterterrorism and general security operations. And that's why they're just not ready. The problem with the aircraft, the F-16s going back and forth, is a little more interesting. There is obviously a lot, a bunch of generals and other senior officers who want F-16s. I mean, it's prestigious for one thing. Let's not forget that angle. But they also have to worry about mainly Iran. What stops it most of the time is the fact that there's never enough money. And the reason there's never enough money, despite all the oil they're shipping, is the corruption. So you can say, with some degree of accuracy, the reason why Iraq cannot defend its airspace is because too many people are stealing the money. This is also a problem with all military procurement. They have managed, as far as I can tell from, the reports I get, that it's no longer a huge problem with, the Phantom soldiers and troops just not getting paid because their regimental commander pocketed the money and went off to Abu Dhabi. So they have cracked down on that. You never hear good news. there's still a lot of plundering going on when it comes to buying or even negotiating to buy things like tanks, artillery, armored personnel carriers, support equipment, bridging equipment. I think only one of the engineer battalions in the Army has bridging equipment. And that's the sort of stuff that the corrupt officials love to glom onto because, A, it's not sexy. B, that means people won't pay attention when they steal all the money. You know, nobody will miss it when it doesn't show up. So the M1 tanks will show up, but, you know, a lot of the more obscure armored vehicles, you know, aren't going to make it or will make it much fewer numbers or in much worse condition because, you know, so much of the money was stolen. This is a huge problem. For example, one of the less sexy aspects of military operations is maintenance. You know, there are several battalions of maintenance troops in every American Army division because there's just so much stuff you got to fix, not just vehicles, but electronics, you know, more complex weapons. Well, half of the Hummers in the Iraqi Army are out of action at any given time because there simply aren't enough mechanics. In fact, we have a piece coming up probably next week. It'll show up. Exploring out that there's a huge shortage of mechanics in Iraq because for so many years, not many people owned vehicles because, you know, the EU started in 1970 when Saddam invaded Iran, all of a sudden the economy went through a huge change. All the money went into buying weapons, Scud missiles, you name it, throwing subsidies at especially at Shia families who had lost a son in the army. So all of a sudden, you know, for the next 30 years, there were simply fewer vehicles on the streets and less need for mechanics. Since Saddam has been overthrown, the economy, again, good news you don't hear about, the economy has been booming despite the corruption. You know, the market economy does work in spite of all sorts of obstacles. And there are a lot more vehicles on the road. So if the Army trains a mechanic, as soon as his enlistment is up, he's not going to stay in. He can make two or three times as much money as a civilian mechanic. So the Army, between the corruption and competition with, you know, civilian industry, even security. If you're, for example, I've heard that a lot of the people, the guys serving in the elite security, you know, the rapid reaction security forces and what have you, they're constantly being sought by, you know, private security companies, especially the ones who supply bodyguards to big shots or anybody with money, you know, to leave the Army or the police, as the case may be, and, you know, come work for the civilian sector. And that's a constant, you know, a bleed of their best people. So they have both problems that are bad, the corruption, and problems that are good. The civilian economy is booming so much, although I shouldn't count to the need for so many bodyguards as being something good about the civilian economy. Because they still have a lot of kidnapping and you know, banditry and criminal activity in general. But as far as the armed forces go, their biggest problem is not insufficient time to train troops and to develop leaders. The biggest single problem is the corruption. And that's always been the problem, especially in Iraq, you know, literally for thousands of years. I believe the oldest written record we have of military corruption, it's either from Sumer, you know, from Iraq or Egypt. My fingers in my mouth, you know, can't both move that fast to go to, you know, Google and check it out. But anyway, it does go back a long time, and it's a very tough tradition to break. Even though many Iraqis are aware of the fact, you know, they work with American troops, and they ask the question, "Why are you guys so good?" And I had one guy; his son was in the Army, and he said he got asked that in Arabic any number of times. They come up to him, he says, "You Arabic?" You know, he's an American soldier, and they answer him, and they start, you know, just chatting. This often happened on a base, so the guy he was talking to, you know, the civilian, he was reasonably sure he wasn't an Al Qaeda spy. So finally, he turned around and says, "Why the hell are you? What makes you guys so good?" And he just says, you know, same thing. Go to America and, you know, they put politicians in jail. You know, so that's the secret. And I've heard that again and again. And that's a hard thing to institute in a place like, you know, Iraq, where bad politicians shoot back.
Right. Let me make a couple of quick comments on things Jim said. Let's just pick that up about the corruption thing. I know of several cases, two two very well. I got them from the young officers that were assigned to help train and mentor Iraqi battalions, and that was the and I'm here, I won't, I'll go through one of them. And he says, he's basically this, he says, Colonel Bay, the officers I worked with, captains, majors, and then the lieutenant colonel commanding the battalion, understood that they needed to have more accountability, personal accountability and economic accountability. And this young captain had some accounting skills. He started an accounting class for three of the officers there in supply, and these guys applied themselves and said, oh, this is how you do it. It's not that there aren't people that don't, they understand that. The question is that you're fighting, as Jim said, a tradition, and that's very, very difficult and very slow to change. The second one is, and I'll relate to this, I don't have the material anymore. I tossed it out a couple of years ago, but I was given in 2005 when I made a trip back to Iraq, which I wrote about on the strategy page, a handout from one of the developmental aid groups that had specifically put together a program to help educate diesel electrical generator mechanics, but they would also in this, you know, engine mechanics. I don't remember the total number that they had planned to run this small program, but it was so oversubscribed. They had literally overwhelmed by hundreds of Iraqis saying, you know, I'd like these skills because they're immediately useful. One thing, keeping up the home generator or the generator for the apartment house due to the intermittent electricity service, but also for adapting, ultimately not moving out of the generator into keeping diesel engines running, because it would it was useful in so many other sectors of the economy as well. Once again, the people that know what they need. Question is, how much time does it take? And some of this, as you know, when you're dealing with developing human skills on this, it takes time. Why does it take 5 years to build an effective Air Force fighter squad? Because you're going to have to teach the pilots. Pilots have got to go through the process and learn the skills. Even, let's say, in the Iraqi Air Force as it exists now, even with its primary turboprop and helicopter, it's got some very, very able pilots in it. But they're going to transition to F-16s, learn all the weapons. And it's not just the pilots, of course. It's all the guys that fix the engines. It's all the ordnance guys that put the weapons on. It's the ground control guys. It's an entire system. You're having to educate people. It's not just buying the technology. It becomes an organization. And it takes a while to put effective organizations together, even when you have people that know what they need to do and they're committed to doing it. And as Jim said, you know, the Iraqi military has done a fairly good job on the internal security mission. And I do mention that in the column, but border security, in other words, classical conventional security, they got some issues. They know it. They had to concentrate on job one. So, again, this is I'm speaking from a practical, pragmatic assessment of what Iraq needs, and also what's in the U.S. interest. But you've got political loggerheads and the political tangle, and people have said a lot of different things. Now they're having to backtrack on it. So, what else is there, Dan?
Yeah, I guess what they'll have to do is find some way to save base with, like, what they did last year, which was they said combat operations have ended, making people feel like, oh, we're done with Iraq, when we really left 50,000 troops there.
Yes, and they were actually organized for combat, but they were also organized for training. In other words, sure, they normally they went spent their time as training groups, but they still had the weapons. They were all, you know, combat experienced troops. So if things really got dicey, they'd all just go back, you know, man their vehicles and grab all their heavy weapons and do whatever had to be done.
Right.
Which never happened to you.
I guess next time maybe what we ought to discuss is how we're going to wind down Afghanistan, because that's coming up too.
Well, Afghanistan is a different problem. in that there's an elephant in the room that nobody really wants to talk about. I'm surprised by this. And that's the heroin. Now, one thing we reported on recently is the fact that the, again, this good news never gets reported. The last year's campaigning in Afghanistan hurt the heroin gangs a lot, a whole lot. And we reported on that regularly. And the latest, you know, I think UN keeps tabs of this, data coming out shows that Afghanistan is down to about 80% of the world's heroin supply. It's probably lower than that. Burma had more than doubled its share from 5 to 12%. And Mexico is up to 7%.
Yeah.
So as it gets more hostile for poppy cultivation in Afghanistan, and most of that is in two provinces, Helmand and Kandahar. That's something else people don't realize. You know, most Afghans do not like opium. You know, because basically it turns their kids into zombies. I mean, kids are hard enough to deal with in a place like Afghanistan, but when they're basically, you know, zonked out of their mind, you know, zombies, you know, stealing and disgracing the family, you know, in ways, you know, people could never imagine, it upsets people, especially in a very family and tribe-based, you know, society. Every time they have a jurga of all the tribal chiefs, the first thing everybody wants to talk about is the drug problem. And as we pointed out many times, the only people benefiting from the heroin trade, I mean, it's only 10% of the population benefits, and that includes farmers, you know, people working, gunmen, Taliban, what have you. And what happens to the other 90%? They suffer. Every neighbor of Afghanistan has a huge problem. There are over 10 million addicts just in Afghanistan and surrounding countries. And this doesn't get much. I mean, I think the Times did one piece or two pieces and what have you. But you talk to locals, and that's what they are angry about. And that's what you're going to hear about in China pretty soon, because the reason why the production is increasing in Burma is not so much because the tribes are still fighting with the government. That's been going on for centuries, but because the demand is rising quickly in China, where there's more money. It's amazing how that works. Mexico is the same reason, having a harder time getting a dependable supply out of Afghanistan. So, you know, some guy down there said, hey, poppies, we can grow them down here. Not a problem. And, of course, that may not last long because, as Austin keeps pointing out in his reporting on Mexico, it's, you know, that whole gangster business is becoming, you know, much less popular as the years and go by and the body counts, you know, climb towards the sky.
Well, one little sidelight on the Mexican bit that's worth putting in. I don't know that this connects to the current growth in Mexican heroin exports, but the United States in World War II asked Mexico to start growing poppies because we needed morphine for the war effort. And the Mexican government complied and had farmers growing poppies, and they were giving us the base.
There's probably still a large, legitimate poppy cultivation in Mexico because, again, something else people don't realize, those opiates are produced in huge quantities, much more than the illegal, you know, heroin, for legitimate, although, you know, prescription only. Morphine and the dentist numbs you with and what have you. There's a lot of new drugs that use opiates, you know, in the last 20, 30 years.
Well, that's why I guess I really wasn't clear. I told you I didn't think this connected to Mexico's growth in heroin, but they do that. It's a legitimate industry. It was one third by the United States. So.
What's happened is there was a huge, us old timers can remember this, heroin used to be a big deal when things were booming in the Golden Triangle, basically northern Burma. And then after the Vietnam War, China and Burma and Thailand decided, okay, enough of this heroin crap, and they basically put them out of business. And overnight, there was hardly any heroin around. It ended up back in the 80s. It started popping up in Pakistan. Where else? Why am I surprised? But even the Pakistanis said, no, not this. And they basically pushed it across the border into Afghanistan, which was at that point, in chaos. They said, hey, give the Russians something else to worry about. And there it's remained ever since. But, heroin is a very unpopular guest. They eventually, the heroin, the poppy trade eventually outgrows its usefulness and gets ejected. But at the same time, there's a huge legitimate poppy cultivation. But as Austin points out, that provides a skill set, in any country that produces legitimate opiates for people to say, I could do this out in the state park back there where nobody ever goes.
Right. Well, that's a good place to end, and we'll talk to you next time, gentlemen.
Right. Bye-bye.
Bye, Dan.